Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. 2 weeks ago, the stock markets were setting record highs, but since Labor Day, they've turned down. Ross takes a close look at why. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Longtime BC trader Victor Adair checks in from Vancouver Island to comment on the latest on the markets. He tells us interest rate cuts are on the way in the U.S., but may be too late to deal with the downturns in so many economic sectors. Victor examines gold, crude, and copper. Publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, Robert Campbell, updates us on the state of the U.S. real estate market and addresses the question, are illegal immigrants really getting free houses in California? We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be back with you, Jim.
Do we have a special offer for our listeners?
Yeah, for new subscribers, 25% off an annual subscription. And at this time of year, this becomes one of those, I think, great opportunities to come on board as, the market is under pressure right now. And typically you'd be looking for September, October to be poor months, but they also tend to be periods that form important bottoms. And we've got a lot of our technical work that fits with Bob's work as far as the historicals are concerned. But with the technicals, we will invariably end up with some good oversold readings in here during the market breaks. And we'll be looking for sectors that start to outperform and become good buying opportunities. So on the website, chartsandmarkets.com, there's a link there for a new subscription.
And Bob is market historian Bob Hoy.
Right. That's Bob and I have been associates off and on for, gosh, the better part of 25, 30 years now. So it's a partnership that works.
Ross, the stock markets were setting record highs just 2 weeks ago. What's going on now?
2 weeks ago, everything was rosy. No, it wasn't. there were a lot of internal problems. There was no question about that. But the some of the sectors had come back to life while others were rolling over. I mean, clearly, the Magnificent Seven, led by NVIDIA, had topped out back in April, May, June, and came back 10 days ago, sort of, I guess, the month of August, if you want to look at it. There were recovery bounces, but if you look at the S&P or the Dow, they were basically back testing the highs and creating double tops, whereas the NASDAQ and the Russell, they retraced just a little over a Fibonacci 62%. And then the short-term signals started to get overbought about a week and a half ago. And the early part of this week, things started to break. So by the end of the week, I guess the S&P had its worst week since March of 2023. And the long-term perspective, we've been looking at that chart that goes all the way back to the 1920s. and the upper trend line resistance in the S&P was 5,400 to 5,600. That's where we've been rolling up in here. And tops usually are created not as a spike and then straight down. Individual stocks might do that, or commodities. But markets as a whole, they tend to create rolling tops. And that's clearly what we've got in here. So, you know, S&P topped early July and retested in late August with a failure. So this is more typical of what you'd see during a market top. And when I look at the charts at the end of the week here, every one of the 16 sectors I look at have had a pretty rough week. And, you know, the only ones, you know, individual items that were up at all during the week, bonds had a good rally as the employment numbers and economic numbers started to soften. But even the bonds ended up basically flat on Friday after a pretty good early part of the week. We have seen an important thing here as far as interest rates is concerned. The yield curve has uninverted. If we take a look at the 10-year bond note versus the 2 years, that now we have 10-year rates just above U.S. 2 years, and this is the first sign since 2022 that that has happened. Historically, an inversion in the yield curve, when it undoes itself and comes back, that tends to be a good leading indicator for a recession or at least an economic contraction.
What's going on with gold?
Gold was holding up reasonably well this week. We ended up back into the mid-2500s, but couldn't manage to push through on the upside. Closed off the week with a poor day, and just sitting under $2,500 at this point. It really has been moving with the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar bottomed here with the 58-day cycle. That was in the last week of August, and had a good bounce back to its 20-day moving average. And while the dollar was rallying, gold had a setback into the early part of this week, into Tuesday. And then we saw the dollar index peak out against its 20-day moving average, which is a normal resistance part of the decline. And it's backed off, and the dollar index now has a double bottom, while gold looks as though it might be creating a double top. So if we take a look at the two of them as a combination, the extremes that we saw on Tuesday, the high in the dollar index and the lower in gold, if we exceed those numbers downside or upside in this next couple of weeks, that would be a catalyst for, I think, a more significant drop in gold. Ideally, the first move would be around 2,400, but 2,300 looks like a far better support, and we're at 2,500 or thereabouts right now. So there's some vulnerability as far as the gold is concerned. And the miners, if you look at the GDX or the GDXJ, those ETFs have not performed well as the dollar bottomed out, as to be expected there. And the gold miners, and not just the miners, but the exploration companies as well, taking a bit of a hit with the overall equity market. So if we take a look at the cycle for the dollar index and relate that then to gold, we're probably looking at a stretch here through September that would be heavy for gold. And as the dollar might move through the 101 level, that really could be a pretty good move on the upside for the currency. And the other currencies have, while the dollar was bottoming out, the other currencies topped. And if we take a look at the commitment of traders numbers, there were some extremes there in the last month or two that have been taken care of. Now, I guess the Canadian dollar was probably top of the list. We were looking at record numbers for the commitment of traders numbers. The speculative net long positions were at all-time highs up until 10 days ago. 2 weeks ago. And now we've seen this big short covering rally. The dollars, Canadian dollar has gone from 72 to 74 and three quarters. And there's been a pretty good drop percentage-wise, about a 70% decline in the net long positions of the speculators. So they've clearly had a rough week or so. So I would expect that there's probably some more to be had on the short covering on the Canadian dollar, but look for a bit of a trading range as we move through the next couple of weeks.
What's the story on crude?
Crude, there's another one. We're into the seasonally weak period. It actually could stretch right to the end of the year with some bounces along the way. The signals that I've got, short-term technicals are oversold as of Thursday and Friday. Friday was a really bad day for the oil market. I would think you're probably looking at maybe a turnaround on Monday, Tuesday for a pretty good bounce back. However, the commitment of traders numbers have been really good at recognizing important bottoms over the last decade or so. And at this point, those numbers are not near the type of extremes that we would look for at a bottom. So I think even if there's a bounce in the crude oil market, we probably need to see it go lower before we can get any kind of a longer-term position. And, you know, maybe that doesn't come until the season will start to look better as we get out towards December.
Ross, again, can you remind people where they can get your special offer?
The website is chartsandmarkets.com, and the offer for the 25% reduction on subscriptions for new subscribers right there on the front page.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
You're welcome, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Victor Adair next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC. He's speaking to us from Parksville on Vancouver Island. He's still very active in the markets. You should check out his website, victoradair.ca. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
Before we discuss individual markets, what's top of mind right now, especially that summer's over, the so-called adults are back at work on the trading desk?
Well, you know, there is something to that. We often call August the silly summer season. And in truth, a lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere anyway are away from the desk in the summertime. And as you were saying in your intro, you know, I was in the brokerage business for nearly 50 years. You just noticed over time, not every year, but most of the time, when the markets reopened after Labor Day, it was like with a bang, you know, and we often reversed some of the things that had been happening during the silly summer season in August. And I think we've seen that again this year. So, there's so much going on. In the summer, it felt a bit flaky or whatever, but, you know, as we're going into the fall, there's some serious stuff happening around the world, some significant moves going on in the markets. And, you know, probably one of the ways that I look at things is that if a market gets going too far one way, and, you know, trying to guess what too far actually means is a big test, but when a market really makes a big move one way, sometimes you're wondering if it's not, let's say, vulnerable at the best for a correction. So I think a lot of the things that we had developed in the markets over the last couple of years, and for instance, one of the things, the stock market has basically gone up for the last 15 years. And certainly since the COVID crisis in 2020, so the last 4 years, we had the stock market take a dip in the early part of August, and retail did not panic. They took it honestly as a buying opportunity, buy the dip, as they say. Well, you know, the market bounced back, and last week we had the major American stock indices, as well as the Toronto market, close at all-time highs. But when they rang the bell to start trading in September, there was a turn here, and we've had the stock markets down every day this week, and the markets may be just a little rocky. So I think that's kind of top of mind for me, and how that plays out in the different markets, whether it's commodities, currencies, interest rates, or stocks. I think we're in a new season, and of course there's a couple of other variables like an upcoming election in the United States that, you know, spice up the soup.
The consensus on the Fed now seems to be that they're laser focused on employment, not inflation. Do you agree with that, and what should we be watching for?
I absolutely do agree. I mean, it seems for so long, I almost feel like a broken clock here, but, you know, it's been all about the Fed. I think since Alan Greenspan, you know, that goes back 25 years. I mean, the Fed and what the Fed going to do, what the market thinks the Fed's going to do, has just been so important to the market that, it's, in a way, as though not much else mattered. So, yes, the Fed classically has a dual mandate. They're to create full employment and keep prices level, for lack of a better word. They have been focused very, very much on getting inflation down for the past couple of years. They started to raise interest rates in, March of 22, raised them for about 15 months, and then, you know, went sideways, went from zero, basically, up to just a little better than 5%. And inflation, whether because of what they did or coincidentally, let's not go there, inflation has come down somewhat from the very high levels it was at before they started raising rates. They feel as though, and they're cautious. I think they've been stung before about being wrong, so they're cautious. But they feel as though inflation is not anywhere near as much a problem now as it was, say, a couple of years ago. And at the same time, they're looking at the other side of their mandate, employment, full employment they're supposed to be creating. And clearly, we're seeing a slowing in the growth of new jobs being created. It's not like, you know, we're net losing jobs. It's just that the rate of gain has been reduced. And that kind of sets up, and Powell said this last month at the Jackson Hole meeting, it's now time for the Fed to start cutting rates. So the market is expecting that. And what should we be watching for? Well, one of the things that just loomed very large on everybody's pay attention to thing was the unemployment data that was released yesterday, Friday. And we were hoping, I guess, the market was hoping that there would be some clear evidence there as to whether the Fed was going to cut by a quarter or by a half at their next meeting on September the 18th. But, you know, wouldn't you know it, the data wasn't really all that clear, so we're still kind of tossing a coin, I guess, as to whether they'll go a quarter or a half. What the market is doing, pricing out over the next, where are we at, 15 months or so, to the end of December of next year, the market is pricing about 225 basis points of cuts. In other words, cutting interest rates effectively, short-term rates, in half from where they're at now. So the things to be watching for now, you know, coming in this next week, the CPI data on Wednesday is going to be that much more important again. We know that, I mean, it would take something pretty dramatic for the Fed to not cut. It's just, you know, how much are they going to cut, how fast are they going to cut, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, we'll be watching. Coming up here, the CPI will be the next big thing before the meeting itself the week after that.
The Fed stopped raising rates back in July 2023. The next move is to cut, but is that bullish for stocks?
No, short answer. And 2 years ago, I would have said absolutely. In fact, maybe a year ago, I would have said yes. I wrote many times in my blog about how the market kept anticipating what I called peak hawkishness from the Fed. In other words, the Fed is hawkish. You have to keep jamming interest rates up to try to get inflation down. And there was going to come a point at some time the market was hoping where the Fed would actually stop raising rates and let rates down, and or bring rates down. And that would be, I called it, a green light special to buy stocks. Like the market would be giddy at the prospect of the Fed cutting next week or whatever. Now that's changed. My take now is, and I'm not alone on this, that a cut from the Fed is a concern that the economy is slowing so much that we might slide into, call it a soft landing or a full-out recession, whatever. And with stocks trading at like a 21 times multiple on the S&P with the forward earnings expectations at record highs, I've said this many times recently, but this is a momentum market here. This is certainly not a value market at these prices. And if the economy is going to be slowing, you know, jobs are down, the consumers are going to spend less, and consumer spending is 70% of the economy and that sort of thing, if the Fed is seeing a slowdown ahead, that might mean that the earnings and the corps aren't going to be as strong, and therefore, you know, cutting interest rates is a sign of weakness, not an opportunity to go out and load up on stocks.
The Dow, the S&P, the TSE Composite Indexes all closed at record highs last week, but they've all been falling this week. How come?
Okay. I've got a sort of a big picture view that the market is really richly valued, and there's way more likelihood that we could, you know, fall 5,000 points on the Dow rather than rally 5,000 points on the Dow. Okay, that's kind of the skew I have. I'm more inclined to be bearish at these levels than to be bullish. So I think there's that in the market. And something else that I see is that over the past years, the people that are in the market really have drank the Kool-Aid, you know, in terms of the market always goes up. Yes, it'll have little dips here and there and so on, but, you know, you just can't go wrong by putting a good chunk of money in the stock market. Don't try to time it. Don't try to pick stocks. Just buy the whole market. Just keep putting a little money in every month, and, you know, you're going to be rich. Okay, that's called passive investing. I'm playing it up. I'm a little bit of a sarcastic here, but my experience in 50 years is it just ain't that easy, buddy. It really isn't. But people want to believe that. I said moments ago that when we had that dip in, for the NASDAQ from the middle of July to early August, I think we were down about 20%. That's more than a dip, but the S&P was maybe off 10%. But I said, retail didn't panic. You know, they've been trained, let's say, or they've come to believe that these little dips are just buying opportunities because the market keeps going up. When somebody's in a frame of mind like that, and the market is going up, you know, you're validated. One of the things that some of the people are going to do is become more aggressive. They say, geez, this is easy. Let's buy more. Let's buy, you know, 0 days to expiry options where we can just, you know, just make money like there's no tomorrow. And let's get into, instead of buying an ETF for some sector of the market, like, for instance, technology, let's buy one of those triple X ETFs, which if the market goes up $10, your ETF goes up 30. Leverage, in other words, I'm talking about. And I think that in more ways than one, the folks in the market have been taking risk. We used to call that a risk-on sentiment, and they've been levering themselves. So I think that adds to the vulnerability. If there was something that caused the market to start to come off at some point, and clearly it needs to be more than a 10% correction in the S&P, people who are in there bullish are starting to go, oh, maybe this is not such a good idea. So that's kind of my thinking. On the charts, when I look at it, I see a double top here in July and end of August, early September in the major indices, with a lower second high. So that's kind of my view on things, and certainly you can tie in the looming slowdown in the economy or a recession, whatever. But I think there is some vulnerability here to the downside on the stock market.
Copper hit all-time highs above $5 in May, but dropped below $4 in early August. There was a weak bounce in mid-August, but the markets turned down again. What's your take?
We've talked about this a bit before, but I mean, copper is just an incredible narrative. The story on copper, basically, you know, we're going to electrify everything. The grid needs to be doubled in size, and you know, we're going to need zillions of tons of copper to meet the electrification of our future. It is such a credible story. That's the demand side. And then on the supply side, you know, you can make a laundry list of why there is no supply. You know, it takes 15 years to permit a mine or something, and you know, then you got country risk. Nobody wants a copper mine in their backyard, or they're going to tax the hell out of it or take it away from you. Or so, you know, there's just not anything near the supply that people have been anticipating. So, boom, you know, we raised copper up to over $5. I mean, I remember trading copper in the 70s, and it was 50 cents, you know. So it's a 10x from those times. But funny things happen in the market, and one of the old adages is the best cure for high prices is high prices, because substitutions get found or other kind of innovations happen so that, you know, the high price wasn't justified. And copper also was just a terrific example of everybody and his dog jumping on the bandwagon. It was like, this is a you can't lose kind of a deal. You just buy copper, you get rich, you know. What they used to say, buy diamonds, you know, buy bonds, wear diamonds. So copper had a great run to the upside. We've had a correction. I understand the bullish story on it. I think it's a good story. But, you know, I try to trade price action rather than stories, and I think that is what happened to copper. Where do we go from here? I think there is going to be clearly a greater demand for copper going forward than what we've seen in the past. But, and there's always a but, one of the buts is China. China looks like they're in a kind of a deflationary trajectory right here, right now. Bond yields in China are at all-time lows. The stock market's been trending down for 7 months. Everybody knows, I should say, most everybody should know, you know, about some of the horrible developments in their property markets over there. You know, and then they got one-man king dictator who is running the whole show because he thinks he can. And, you know, it seems as though the Chinese citizens, God bless them, you know, have been stung, and they're not spending money. The economy is slowing down. I think it's been a great market for Chinese speculation in the gold market, just as, you know, if you were reasonably rich in China over the past couple of years, you probably would have done well just to buy some gold and sell some of the other things that you own. So I think that also is going to play into copper. China's been a big player or big player in the copper market. And if their demand continues to soften, I mean, they even might see a ramping up of the recycling in copper. So when you're trading a market, you know, whether it's crude oil or copper or Deutschmarks, for crying out loud, you know, you just need to understand that you don't know nearly as much as you should, because you can't. There's things going on out there you just can't know about. And doesn't mean you shouldn't try. And if you see a lot of other people are doing something like buying copper, you can jump on the bandwagon with them for a while and take advantage of the ride. But for me, you really, really, the thing that makes the difference on your P&L is the price action. So believe the price action ahead of the story.
WTI crude oil closed at $68 this week, a 15-month low. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, maybe it's more of the same as to what I was saying about copper. There are some news bits, okay? OPEC this week said, last week or the week before, we said we were going to, at our meeting in October, we were going to expand our production quotas so we could, everybody who was part of the group could pump a little more oil, make some more money. Well, we'll put that off. So that was sort of bullish news, but it was like a drop of water hitting a hot stove. I think what is happening there with crude is lack of demand. You know, the classic commodity. What's the demand? What's the supply side look like? And it would seem the economy in China is cooling. The economy in the United States is cooling. I mean, that crude oil's at a 15-month low. Gasoline prices, wholesale gasoline, I think we're at about a 30-month low on that. And that is, you know, very much on the demand side. Now, people who are sort of always bullish on crude will say I'm wrong about that stuff. But again, you know, I'm trading the price. I'm not trying to be the smartest guy in the room in terms of knowing all the ins and outs of the stuff that nobody else knows. Crude has traded in a two-year sideways pattern with a high of about, call it $90 and a low of about 70. And now we're, I guess, through the bottom of that range. We're seeing it reflected in crude oil. We're seeing it with the commodity indices. I think the Goldman Sachs commodity index is at a three-year low here. It's not just crude. You know, it's not just copper. You know, the grain markets are down and so on and so on. I mean, you look around in the commodity sector, with the exception, the notable exception of orange juice, which is just soaring to new all-time highs, commodities are kind of on the back foot. So I think it's got to be related to lack or a reduced demand, or at least reduced demand relative to previous expectations. That's what's going on, and the price action is reflecting it.
In your weekly trading desk notes at victoradair.ca, you've been writing about the massive speculative short position in the Canadian dollar. How's that playing out?
Well, it's been a terrific story. You see, the Canadian dollar hit its recent high back in December of last year when the U.S. dollar was weak against most currencies. And since then, the Canadian dollar has started to drift down and then drifted down at a little faster rate. And speculators were paying attention, and they started shorting the Canada, and it was a good ride. So they started shorting, like, in size in March and kept shorting it, and then the Canada plunged in August, and they really added to their positions. And I put a couple of charts up on my blog over the last few weeks just to show the size of this short position. It wasn't just the largest ever short position in the Canadian dollar. It was the largest ever short position by a country mile. It was huge. And I worked out that the average price of these short positions was going to be around 73 cents. And, you know, certainly so long as the market stayed at 73 cents and below, people who were short probably would feel comfortable with their positions. And then the Canadian dollar hit its low the same day the stock market made its lows in early August. I think it was August the 5th or something like that, and turned higher. So here is just, you know, the news on the Canadian dollar is just so bearish, and the positioning is so bearish, and the Canadian dollar makes a new low and then turns higher. To me, that is like it's either a news failure or it's just a bullish signal for me when a market is, you know, so bearish, but the price rebounds from making a new low, I'm interested. Now, I started trade the Canadian dollar from the long side and did that throughout most of August on the expectation that if the Canadian dollar is rising, then this massive short position, those people got to come in and start to cover their shorts. They got to buy the market. Now, believe me, I'm not the only guy that saw this. I think everybody that was a currency trader in the world saw this. It's like a big sore thumb sticking out, okay? And everybody could see it the same way. If the Canadian dollar starts to rally, there's a lot of buying needed to be done, or the people who are short could be taken to the cleaners. So Canadian dollar rallied 2.5 cents from the August lows to the end of August highs. The largest one-month gain we've seen in this year, maybe going back a little further than that. And you know, we watched, sure enough, the weekly reporting on the positioning in the market from the Commodity Futures and Trading Commission showed us that the shorts were starting to cover their positions. Now, the positioning on something like this isn't just like overnight, and these guys are slow to cover because they probably have a long look-back period. In other words, they're saying, where's the Canada been over the last 12 months or 6 months or whatever. But at the highs here last week, the last reporting we had, about half or so of the short positions were covered. So, you know, there's still a substantial, compared to history, short position in the Canada. And I've turned the other way. I think the Canada had a pretty good rally here, 2.5 cents, the biggest one-month up move, you know, we've seen this year. And I've turned around, and I'm on the short side looking for Canada to go back down again.
You've also been writing a lot about the gold market. What are the highlights?
Well, gold's been on a hell of a tear, right? I mean, here was something, and I said this to somebody recently, but this just goes to show you what an exciting life I had. I noticed that the gold market had been up for 7 consecutive months. With the where are we at here? August being the last month in that 7 months of consecutive higher prices. And I thought, gee, that seems like a hell of a run. And I went back and checked every month back to when we began trading gold futures in 1975. And I could not find another example of the gold market being up 7 months in a row. It was just a first. Well, how about that? And that kind of backed up my view that people are really bullish on gold, you know, and with the price here around all-time highs above $2,500 an ounce, you know, all-time nominal highs at least, and with positioning in the futures market here at the highest level it's been at in over 4 years. So you got to go back to the COVID panic of March of 2020. For instance, the speculators in the gold market are more bullish now than they were after Russia invaded Ukraine when we had the last big jump. So it's kind of like, oh, everybody that's bullish gold owns it. You know, they're loaded up, just like the Canadian dollar bears. Well, this is the gold market bulls. They're all in, as it were. So I'm inclined to look for opportunities to fade it. Now, I have traded gold, believe me, for more than 50 years, whether it's futures or options or shares or that sort of thing. I've been an active trader in the gold market, and I've gone certainly both ways on it. And on balance, no surprise, I've been long. And I understand, you know, the bullish story on gold, but right now I think the market is probably a little ahead of itself, is vulnerable to a bit of a correction. Now, a bit of a correction doesn't mean it goes, say, down to $1,000. You know, for me, the gold market fell $200. I mean, that is a very worthwhile kind of a move for me to catch.
The U.S. dollar index has been near 2-year lows the past 2 weeks. Is the market bearish on the greenback?
Yes, the market is. There, in the case of the Canadian dollar, the market is short the Canadian dollar and long the U.S. dollar. But for all of the other, most all of the other currencies that we trade in the futures markets, traders are bullish. And, you know, the biggest currency pair is the euro against the U.S. dollar or vice versa. And in terms of sizing across markets, what happens in the Canada-U.S. dollar a relationship doesn't matter, you know, because the euro is just so much bigger. But the market right now is probably the longest on the euro that it's been, I don't know, certainly in several months. I think the play here has been a couple of things. Well, actually, let's do a little divergence. You had to go to the yen. The yen dropped to like about a 35-year low, and that's going back about 2 months now. And we had the Japanese authorities come in and do a master class, honestly, in intervention in the market. They caught the market at just a great time. They came in on a CPI day in the United States. The U.S. dollar was starting to gain anyway, and the yen just pardon me, the yen went from being near a 35-year low and just went off on a great rally, and part, a good chunk perhaps of that rally, was fueled by people who had been heavily short the yen. So right now, I think the play in the currency markets, and this is at a very, very general level, has been the expectation that the Fed is going to be more aggressive about cutting interest rates than other central banks. I think that the American interest rates are generally, across different points on the yield curve, are almost always higher than the other currencies, unless you know you go to Turkey or Brazil or something, or put them in the same boat that the UK. But interest rate differentials are extremely important in the currency markets, and I think maybe in the summer period here that the U.S. dollar got beat up a little more than maybe it should have. And I think that the play has been because of the expectations of the Fed. I'm not sure that the Fed is going to be anywhere near as aggressive in cutting rates as the market expects, and or they're certainly not going to be a lot more aggressive in cutting interest rates than other central banks. So I'd say maybe predisposed to be a buyer of the U.S. dollar here rather than a seller. Again, I'm talking as a trader, you know, not, you know, where I think it's going over the next couple of years.
Before we wrap up, what are your thoughts on the American election and what's on your radar for the next week or two?
Oh, the election. Well, I got a couple of thoughts on that. Clearly, coming up on Tuesday is the debate between Harris and Trump. I think that will be really key to understanding how the election will go. And let's just do a segue on that. The vote is on the 5th of November, and I think it's very possible that we will not know who won the election on November the 5th. I think there's a great possibility that that might take some time to sort out, and certainly some people will be very unhappy with whatever the official decision is. But the election is, as I say, November the 5th, so it's less than 2 months away. This is going to be, it's going to have people scratching their heads. I mean, as a for instance, let's say, you know, you've made several millions of dollars speculating in the stock market over the last few years, and you haven't taken any profits, or you still got a lot of unrealized gains there, subject to capital gains if you sell the positions. Now, would you think of maybe selling some of that stuff now before the election, because it's possible after the election that the tax rate on capital gains is going to be higher than it is now, if Harris is in power, for instance. So does that mean between now and the election there might be more than one person in that kind of a vote, in that kind of a boat, who would be a net seller into the market? Then, you know, it's the two candidates are very different from one another, obviously. And they're going to have their respective bases, you know, that will vote for them regardless. But it's the undecided people in the middle who are going to make the difference. And certainly everybody should have, if they're paying attention to politics, you know, understand that there's about seven states, and right at the top of the list is Pennsylvania, that are going to make all the difference. You know, you can win more votes across the country than the other candidate, but if you win in the right states and you get more electoral college votes, then you win the election. So there's a lot of nuances here as to how it's going to play out. I think the election or the campaign really begins on the debate on Tuesday, and it's just going to get more intense as we go toward the end of the year. And it's not just Americans that are going to be looking at this. You know, clearly the rest of the world is. There's different people around the world, I'm thinking Europe in particular, who are wondering if they can get along with Trump if he gets reelected. Other people who may be in a more adversarial position with the Americans wonder if they're better off with Trump or Harris. I think it's just going to be a more stressful time as we go from now until the election. So on my radar, front and center, this coming week is that debate between the two of them. I mentioned earlier the CPI data is coming out on Wednesday. That's going to be very key for the Fed, I think. If the CPI data, for instance, comes out hotter than the market's expecting, then for sure you're going to take a 50 basis point cut at the September 18 meeting off the table. And they're still really likely to cut a quarter, but, you know, the 50 basis points is gone. So, I probably got a zillion things on my radar, Jimmy, but those are two of the highlights, the debate and the CPI number next week.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, honestly. This is kind of fun. Thank you.
My guest has been Victor Adair. His website, victoradair.ca. He was speaking to us from beautiful Parksville on Vancouver Island. Coming up, Robert Campbell, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, publisher of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. His website, realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from San Diego. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. Happy to be here.
When's the next issue of the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter going to be published?
I'm coming out. I'm writing it right now, and it'll be published on or about the 15th of September.
Is this a good time to get your book, Timing the Real Estate Market?
It's always a good time to get that book. Timing is everything, everybody. Timing is everything. You know, I mean, is real estate a good long-term investment? Yes. Is real estate always a good short-term investment? No. Decidedly no. You can go bankrupt in the short term, waiting for the long term to re-exert itself.
In Canada, we've had over 200 housing developers go bankrupt in the past year. What's that telling us about the housing market?
That tells you the housing market is getting weak, obviously. And that's a very, very interesting sign, Jim, because I come from a development family. My dad was a builder-developer for 55 years. I was a builder-developer for 10 years. There's nothing more exciting than building. I mean, it's a creative process. It's exciting. There's nothing that you can make more money at than a successful real estate development. And there's no riskier business in the world, maybe than drilling for oil. So it's a high profit, high risk business. So when you say these guys go bankrupt, it's all done on borrowed money and typically construction loans, which typically carry a 1 to 2 year due date. And if you get into a bad market, there's no way you're going to roll over that construction loan, and you just declare bankruptcy, and that's that. I would say here in Southern California, I've been around the development business my entire life, you know, let's say, you know, over 70 years. I have friends that are still in the business, and when we talk about it, sometimes we say, what percent of all real estate developers do you think avoid going bankrupt? Maybe 10%. 10%. The other 90% go broke. That's how risky it is. Would I avoid the business because of that? Hell no. It's the most exciting business in the world. So, but it's extremely risky. I mean, and so you really have to be on your game to avoid bankruptcy.
This week, the Bank of Canada lowered the bank rate for the third time by a quarter point to 4.25%. What do you think the Fed's going to do?
They're going to drop rates, 100% guaranteed. And I don't think there's any fundamental economic reason for doing that. I think it's a political reason. It's an election year, and the Fed, even though they say to the contrary that, you know, they're not beholden to anybody, which is untrue, and they'll drop rates trying to save the incumbent parties.
What happens after the election?
After the election, that's a great question. What happens after the election is we're going to have a recession. That's when the bad news hits. During a presidential election year, everything is wonderful. The jobs are great. You know, people are happy. You know, everybody's home is worth, you know, $1 million here in California. You know, if you live in San Diego, it's worth $2 million. Everything's great. Now the bad news. Nobody's going to put out any bad news until the election is over, and that's when the proverbial shit hits the fan, and it typically does. If you look at recessions, that's when they're going to come out with the bad news, go, well, sorry, guys, we screwed up. We got to do this, this, and this. We got to shut this down. And that's when the bad news is. They get all the bad news out of the way, and then they start the hoopla for the next presidential election.
So it really doesn't matter who gets elected?
No, it doesn't. No.
Yeah, the Who in their song, there's a new boss, same as the old boss.
Yeah, but nobody's going to give you the bad news before the election, Jim.
Do higher energy prices lead to higher inflation that leads to higher interest rates?
No, not really. Energy prices are just a consequence of supply and demand, and supply and demand is not a big contributing factor to inflation. What is a big factor of inflation is how much deficit spending the government does, you know, and right now the U.S. government's running $3 trillion deficits every year, and how much money they print, that the Federal Reserve prints in order to keep the wheels on the car. That's what causes inflation, not oil prices.
Are there signs that the massive bubbles of debt are running into problems?
I'm 77 years old. When I was younger, I said, oh my God, you know, when the debt was $10 trillion, this can't go on. It's going to lead to a collapse. It never did. It never did. But I will have to say now, the more and more debt you pile on, the more debt you get to the point where the debt to GDP to debt ratio right now in the United States is over 120%. If you read the book by Rogart, This Time It's Different, and he has studied economies going back hundreds of years, anytime the GDP to debt ratio gets over 120%, the end is near. You just can't handle the debt, period. Well, we're there now. So whether it's this cycle or the next cycle, how long they can postpone it, we're getting closer to the end. No economy sustains itself, you know, in a vigorous fashion that with that kind of debt-to-income, GDP to debt ratio. I mean, Japan may be an exception, and I don't understand Japan very well, but most economies, they blow up.
Could the various debt bubbles be fixed without pain?
Nope, they cannot. Everybody thinks, oh, yeah, because one thing, somebody owns the debt. You got to get rid of the debt. That's the only way you're going to get the cure. To, you know, you get over indebted. Like right now in the United States, we're paying, what is it, over $1 trillion a year in interest expense. If interest rates were to keep going up, I mean, and the national debt is increasing by $3 trillion a year plus. And Medicare is going broke in the next couple of years, so add another $1 trillion onto that, and pretty soon the debt is just spiraling up. And even if they can somehow force interest rates to stay low, the amount of money it takes to service that debt at those levels is huge. And now you have to start borrowing money to pay interest on the debt. That's when at some point it becomes unsustainable. And either that or you just hyperinflate, which is not a solution. Just keep printing money and you know, and the that only makes the problem worse. So eventually the debt has to be taken care of. The debt has to be liquidated. And right now in Ukraine, you know, they stopped making payments on their national debt because of the war. I think it's 2 years ago. Well, I think it was BlackRock or Goldman Sachs, whoever handles their debt money for them. They just restructured the debt where they can start making payments again. 37% haircut. And I'm sure there's other favorable terms, too. 37%. So whoever was holding that debt lost 37% of their money. And the debt market, guys, is way bigger than the stock market, way bigger than the real estate market. And it's just, when you see people taking those kind of hits to restructure debt, you got a problem. Like here in the United States, Social Security. Social Security, what assets do they hold? In order to make payments on the promises that they've made? U.S. Treasury debt. How much? 100%. You can't buy anything else. 100%. Because it's supposed to be safe. All of a sudden, if the U.S. couldn't make payments on that debt, and we had to get, let's say, a 40% haircut, would Social Security be in trouble? Yeah, they'd have to decrease the payments by 40%, all else equal. Would that be a problem? Yeah, be a huge problem. What would happen? The whole country would be bankrupt. So, I mean, it's a big deal.
Today we have debt slaves. Are there comparisons between today's debt slaves and historical physical slaves?
That's an interesting question. And I would say no. I just read the other day that back at the when slavery was at its peak, 1.6% of all Americans owned slaves. What percent of all Americans today are quote-unquote debt slaves? I would say 70 to 80%. They're living on debt. Living on debt.
If governments were 50% smaller, would anyone notice?
No, not at all. I've said for years, I said if I took 10 honest economists up to Sacramento, California, which is the capital, and we went over the books for 30 days, we could eliminate 50% of the people, of the programs, before we came home, and nobody would even notice anything happened.
I was going to say, when they had the federal government furlough for 2 weeks, the only thing people noticed was you can't go into a national park. That was it.
All right.
Can't, so, yeah. Okay, so we hire the park rangers.
We hire a park ranger, right.
When shrinking government, is it important to have a growing economy to absorb the unemployed government workers into the private sector?
Of course it's important, but it's the key is how quickly can a growing economy absorb a huge number of people that got laid off because of debt restructuring or a smaller government? It would take a long time. Either that, or you just pull the bandage off real fast, and everybody goes broke all at once. All the poor people are even more poor. You know, half of the rich people are poor, and all of a sudden, and everybody starts over. Where you don't try to pull it off slowly and go, oh, we can't let this outcome occur. Well, it's going to occur, dude. So you got your choice. Back, I think it was back in 1921, the U.S. went through after World War I, went through a major recession. Major. And the government did nothing. Nobody tried to interfere with the free market process. A year and a half later, the economy will start growing stronger than it's ever grown in the history of the country. Did a lot of people go broke in the meantime? You're damn right they did. And they deserve to go broke. You know, they misallocated, they bought things they couldn't afford, invested in things that didn't work out, got into businesses that they never should have got into. But when the government stayed out of the way, the whole thing collapsed around them, and within a year and a half, the government, the GDP in this country was growing faster than ever. So, you know, it's a different version of the same old story. We're here from the government. We're from the government, and we're here to help you. Uh-huh.
How's inflation been stopped in the past?
That's always a question that's subject to a lot of debate. Typically what happens is it dies out on its own. I know people said high interest rates stopped it. Yeah, that'll stop demand, that's for sure. Like Volcker did in the 70s, that'll stop demand. But if you look in other areas like Argentina or Venezuela, those kind of areas, Zimbabwe, it just kind of dies out on its own because the inflation impoverishes the people where they don't have any money anymore, have any money to spend, and you kind of start over just based on natural market forces.
When times got tough in the past, how did gold, stocks, and the owning of debt do?
Well, when times got tough, we're talking inflation tough now. In the past, and I've studied this over history, even going back to the Weimar hyperinflation in the early 1920s, where inflation got to what, like 10,000,000% a year or something ridiculous like that. Gold, silver, and the stock market did really, really well. The last thing you want to own is debt. Last thing you want to own because it becomes worthless. And when I say did well, you held your own, guys. When you get into a bad, bad economic condition, people talk about, oh, taking advantage of somebody else's misfortune. Yeah, that sounds good in theory. And for some people, that may work. On balance, if you can just hang on to what you got during bad, bad economic times, you're head and shoulders above everybody else. People ask me sometimes, they go, are you afraid that, you know, that we could get into bad economic times and everybody's going to, you know, most people are going to lose all their money? And I said, no. I said, I know that I'm only going to lose half of my money, so, because I'm smarter than the average bear. So I'm still going to be on top of the market, I mean, on top of the pile. And that's kind of the way you got to look at it. In a bad market conditions, he who loses the least wins.
How important are precious metals in uncertain times?
They're very important, and especially these kind of uncertain times where technically, by most measurements, the U.S. economy is doing quite well. I mean, unemployment is, what, 4.5%? That's not high. In fact, it's on the low side of things. GDP is growing. We're not in a recession. Then why has gold gone up 40% in the last 2 years? It's a lack of trust in the government, guys. That's what it comes down to. Gold, long-term, is gold a good inflation hedge? Yes. Like you look at over 50 years, gold holds its own very, very well. Stock market does better? Yes, but it's way more volatile. Does real estate do better? Yeah, maybe a little better. Historically, U.S. real estate appreciates about 1% over the rate of inflation over long periods of time. But in the short run, you know, gold can go down, but in the long run, it's a hedge against distrust in the government. Because you look back at what happened to Russia in the early 1900s when they went through that revolution, when the Soviet Union broke up. The people that made out the best were the people that owned gold and got their butt out of the country. They did the best.
Your thoughts on the stock markets as we head towards October and then the 2024 election, November 5th?
I think the stock market's going to keep going up. Because there's just so much money in the system. There's so much deficit spending. So much deficit spending. But I am not qualified to give you expert information on the stock market. I've made almost 100% of my money from real estate, either through real estate development or buying when real estate was depressed or through creating value. That's what I'm good at. The stock market, I've played the stock market, studied the stock market for 50 years. And you know what? I'm not good at it. And I'm not a buy and hold guy because I don't like the volatility.
So, Bob, people move for a number of reasons. Is moving for economic reasons now becoming more prevalent?
Yeah, I think it is, especially out of California. People are moving out of California. That is a fact beyond dispute. And they're typically people that have money, because people that don't have any money can't afford to move. But the reason they move, they're afraid of California. They're afraid of what they're going to do. Like right now that, you know, there's bills, you know, before our state government where they're going to give illegal aliens, $150,000down payment. Who's going to pay so they can buy a house in California? The median price is almost $1 million now, guys. They can buy a house, and they can move into it, and they don't have to make any payments on it. I mean, there's your free lunch. I mean, somebody has to pay for these free lunches. And it's the governments are just becoming, you know, so progressive, you know, leaning toward, you know, people that don't have money. People with money are leaving. If I mean, me, myself, I've lived in San Diego my entire life. I live next to the beach. I mean, is there ever a bad day where I live? No, there is no bad days. You just go to the beach and everything's fine. But if it got bad enough, I would, if I had to move someplace, I'd move to the Mediterranean Sea and live on the beach in Italy or Greece. It's going to be on the beach, but I'm not there yet. And another reason I haven't left California is this. One of the things I'm writing about in my current timing letter is high home prices. Be careful what you wish for. One of my subscribers lives in New Hampshire. He's retired, living on a fixed income. He's lived there his whole life. So he owns his home clear and free and clear and all that. His property taxes in the last 2 years went up 70%. His homeowner's insurance in the last year went up 50%. Guys, he's getting squeezed. So let's just project a little bit here. I know that's risky, but as a thought experiment, let's do that. Let's say that they just keep pumping money into the system, and that home he now owns that's worth $1 million becomes worth $2 million. Now, because in New Hampshire, what they do is if your house goes from $1 million to $2 million, they increase your property taxes by 100%. Here in California, if your homes go from $1 million to $2 million, the most your property taxes can go up in any given year is 2%. So you don't have to worry about getting squeezed that you can't even afford property taxes.
So in most of America, do higher home prices mean higher property taxes?
I would say 50%. Only 50%. Not in California. In New Hampshire, yes. Not in California.
What's the latest on California home prices?
They're going up. Still going up. Unaffordability is flashing red signals, and it's going to go bust. But not yet. So they're still going up. So you have to respect that. And the reason they're going up, for the same reason they're going up everywhere in the United States, it's not because of booming demand. It's because of lack of supply.
What's the latest on the bubble cities in America?
Well, one of the biggest bubble cities, most bubble cities are still hanging in there. A few of them that have done the worst are areas like Austin, Texas. So Austin, Texas just went into a boom. Boom city. Some places like Boise, Idaho, went into the same thing. Everybody scrambled out of California, and because you know they didn't like California, and they moved to the sticks or Austin, Texas, and the prices there just went crazy. Now I understand that housing prices in Austin, Texas, are down 20% from their peak. 20% in California, they may be even with their old peak. They haven't gone down. Some places in Idaho, same thing. Denver's having problems right now. So slowly we're starting to see market forces take their effect because market affordability is so low, and that's a major warning sign. That's where turning points happen, where people can't afford to buy homes anymore.
How are home prices in the rest of the U.S.?
They're doing well. You know, I think that in the U.S. as a whole, they're still going up. They're making higher highs.
15-minute cities and C40 cities. Do you think some people will pay a premium for real estate to live in a 15-minute city or a C40 city?
No, not going to pay a premium. Not going to pay a premium at all. They'll pay a premium to get out of those cities. What those cities are going to do, those 15-minute cities, they're going to turn into ghettos. They're going to turn into government projects where crime is going to soar. And the only people that are going to be able they'll try to step people in there, and the people that will be able to get out are going to be more wealthy people that are going to choose not to live there, and they'll live in the outskirts. That's a pipe dream. Nobody needs a car, you know. Yeah, there's no climate problem anymore. No oil's needed. We can stop drilling. No cars. Everybody can walk around or ride a bike. I don't know who's going to grow the food, but you know what? It's just a dream. Not even close to going to happen. And people think, oh boy, what an ideal place to live. It's going to be just exactly the opposite. When you stuff people together and cram them into a small area, they start eating each other. And that's what's going to happen. That'll put an end to that.
How important is it to walk erect?
It's something new I've learned, guys. In the past month, I've always knew that your legs are your fountain of youth. I've always taken great steps to make sure that my lower half of my body is super, super strong. as compared to the upper half of my body. And walking erect, most people when they get to be my age, they lose 2 inches in height. For one, their spine starts shrinking. Now, I want you guys, to older guys, especially older guys, even you younger guys, to listen to this real closely. I am the same exact height today at age 77 as I was at age 22 at UCLA. I haven't shrunk 1/8 of an inch. Why is that? Is that normal? No, that's very abnormal. Two things. One, I do deadlifts, which I've read is very good for strengthening the spine. And two, when I walk, I throw my hips forward, which is good for your glutes, and I throw my shoulders back, and you walk erect. I don't stoop one little bit. And you know what? You'll maintain that height, and you can't believe what that does for your self-confidence. You walk around like you really own the world. And you know, if you have good health and you stand erect and every other thing's going right, you do own the world. So the conclusion, the last health tip I want to leave you guys with today, if I had to name one body part, and one only, that is most important for long-term strength and health, it would be your glutes. Your glutes. A close second would be your abs. It's not your quads. Are they important? Yeah. Is it your biceps? Not at all. Not at all. None of that. Is it your shoulders? Uh-uh. It's your glutes. So when you walk, think about throwing your hips forward, tightening your butt, and walk like that, and your glutes will get strong, and it'll just change your whole life. You'll just feel better. You'll feel stronger. You'll stand taller. And it'll just, you know what? It's a whole psychological thing. And so, and I figured that out in the last 30 days. It's your glutes. And the reason I found that out is I take my Beagles for 4-mile walks in canyons, up and down canyons. You know, real unbelievable, unlevel places, going over stuff. And when I get done with that, my glutes hurt so much. But that's what you want to keep sore, a good sore. So work on your glutes, guys.
Bob, where can people follow you, buy your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, and subscribe to your newsletter?
They can go to realestatetiming.com, just like it sounds, realestatetiming.com.
Robert, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Robert Campbell. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.